What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Michael Phillips. What's the secret, Josh?
The secret?
Yeah, you seem to have it pretty figured out.
Secret, I don't know. I think you just gotta find something you love to do and then do it for the rest of your life. For me, it's going to Rushmore.
And if you're Wes Anderson, it's making films, like Rushmore. Quirky, aloof, and intricately designed, Anderson's movies can be divisive. This week on Film Spotting, we consider his latest creation, The Grand Budapest Hotel.
And we'll take a look at Anderson's career so far with this week's top five Wes Anderson scenes. That and more.
Come on, let's shag ass.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level.
For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM314.
We're also brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to Squarespace.com and use offer code FILM3. Every once in a while, Michael, a listener who's been using Squarespace, writes in to let us know about their experience with the service. And we recently heard from Annie Gomez, who describes herself as a Brazilian living in Hong Kong. Annie says, thanks for updating me on the latest movies to watch. I'll always be grateful for that. I've always been interested in web development, but since I've been so busy, Squarespace has been a great tool to develop my new website for my hobby, movies. The people at Squarespace replied to every single email I sent regarding my questions on how to use the system, and I got a response in less than 1 hour. Right now, my website is ready to go. I've uploaded many reviews and interviews on independent foreign cinema, and it's been a lot of fun to manage the site. Very simple and easy. And Annie's site is anniegomez.com. We'll provide a link for that in the show notes.
Squarespace is constantly improving their platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. They have beautiful designs for you to start with, and all the style options you need to create a unique website for you or your business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content looks great on every device every time. Squarespace Metric app for iPhone and iPad allows you to check site stats like page views, unique visitors. I'm a unique visitor, actually. And social media follows. With the blog app, you can make text updates, tap and drag images to change layouts, and monitor comments on the go. Easily embed videos and trailers via the simple YouTube and Vimeo integration.
You can start a trial without a credit card. You just start building your website. And then when you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM3. That way you'll get 10% off and you'll show your support for Film Spotting. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson. My adopted daughter, Michael Phillips, is in for Adam Kempinar this week. Hello, Michael.
Thank you for that.
Still finishing up some of the paperwork on that adoption.
Thank you for that Andersonian plot development. That was news to me, in fact.
Well, Wes Anderson takes such care with each frame that it would be easy to choose five favorite moments from any one of his films. But Michael and I have given ourselves a much bigger challenge this week. We've strolled the grounds of Rushmore, walked the halls of the Tenenbaum Mansion, and gone five fathoms deep in Steve Zissou's sub to come up with our top five Wes Anderson scenes. That's going to be later in the show.
But first, Lonely Planet gave it a recommended rating. Time for Josh and I to share our impressions after staying at the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Who's this interesting old fellow?
I inquired of Monsieur Jean. To my surprise, he was distinctly taken aback.
Don't you know?
He asked.
Don't you recognize him?
He did look familiar.
That's Mr. Mustafa himself. He arrived early this morning.
This name will no doubt be familiar to the more seasoned persons among you. Mr. Zero Mustafa was, at one time, the richest man in Zubrovka, and was still, indeed, the owner of the Grand Budapest.
He often comes and stays a week or more, three times a year at least, but never in the season.
Monsieur Jean signaled to me and I leaned closer.
I'll tell you a secret. He takes only a single bed sleeping room without a bath in the rear corner of the top floor. And it's smaller than the service elevator.
That was Jude Law with Jason Schwartzman in a scene early on in Wes Anderson's eighth and latest film, The Grand Budapest Hotel. Grand Budapest represents Anderson's first solo script, and it's fair to say it's his densest narrative. There's at least four layers of story going on here. Not for nothing is that miniature model of the hotel itself looking a little bit like a pink-hued layer cake. Now, for these introductory purposes, Michael, I'll stick to the central plot, and perhaps we'll touch on the other layers as we get into our review. The majority of the film is set in 1932, in the wintry, fictional Eastern European nation of Zubrovka, the home of the world-famous Grand Budapest Hotel. The heart and soul of the hotel is the concierge Gustav, played by Ralph Fiennes. He presides over every aspect of the hotel with panache, with eloquence, and liberal doses of perfume. He also gets very close to the older female guests. And when one, Tilda Swinton, in remarkable old age makeup, is murdered, Gustav is suspected of the crime. So this is part murder mystery, the film. It's also a bit of a heist film when Gustav takes off with the priceless painting that the Swinton character has bequeathed him. And throughout, there's the specter of impending world war in the background as these vaguely German forces make brief intrusions onto the scene. This hint of war also brings me to the subject of the movie's influences. Adam saw the film with me at the same screening, and afterwards he talked right away about the Powell Pressburger nods that he picked up on, particularly The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp and Black Narcissus. What came to my mind while I was watching it was another war comedy, and one we've discussed in a film spotting marathon, The Marx Brothers' Duck Soup. In a way, this movie uses a fictional war's political commentary a little bit similarly. It's certainly the backdrop for a lot of zaniness. In Grand Budapest Hotel, we have this climactic, chaotic shootout among soldiers, and it brought to my mind the war scenes from Duck Soup. Let's start with this question of influences, though, Michael. Did you see these that I've been talking about, or were there perhaps others that stood out more strongly to you? And is this all that Grand Budapest Hotel amounts to, a pastiche, or is it something more, something uniquely its own?
It's a great opening question, Josh, and I think it's probably a testament to the fact that the movie's actually worth talking and arguing about that I didn't come up with those influences, Powell Pressburger, maybe subconsciously a little bit, or the Marx Brothers, because that's a little too broad for most of the humor here. But more than, I think, any other Anderson film, and this is his eighth feature, I believe.
Right.
This is one where you really can tick off a lot of the primary and secondary influences. I mean, this is a script that's dedicated to the writings of the Austrian Jew, Stefan Zweig, who's wrote an amazing autobiography I just read called The World of Yesterday and some other work. You know, he in that autobiography, he's writing about his memories of Vienna's golden age and life between the wars, and then after Hitler comes to power. And Zweig killed himself along with his wife in a double suicide in 1942. So that's an acknowledged influence. And plenty of other ones Anderson's talked about, everything from the early Ernst Lubitsch comedies in sort of this more high-style kind of wit and humor he's going for here. There's an awful lot of Hitchcock, too, and he's acknowledged a lot of it. There's a museum stalking scene that's straight out of
Jeff Goldblum is chased
right
by.
into Torn Curtain, and that leads to the movie's most jarringly violent moment
with Willem Dafoe too, right?
And so you got Hitchcock, you got Lubitsch, you have all kinds of things, and yet this to me is really one of Anderson's most singular creations. I like this film, Josh, better than any of his except Rushmore.
Wow.
Now that may change in a year or two. You never know. And it's been sort of a weird head trip to go back and revisit a lot of Anderson's work in a concentrated period of time, because any filmmaker who's got that distinct and concrete a set of visual building blocks, you know, what he uses to tell that story, the swish pans, the dolly shots, everything, the kind of, you know, the weird mixture of theatricality and cinematics. You know, you got everything from stop motion animation in here and during the ski chase sequence, which is basically straight out of Fantastic Mr. Fox, you know, in the style, you know, how that blends with these very violent moments that are far more violent than anything even Hitchcock pulled. You know, it's a miracle to me almost, although the film is far from perfect, it's a miracle that it all kind of makes sense together. And you're in this created, invented universe that is its own hermetic thing, but it doesn't feel, I didn't get the kind of insularity of feeling that I got in some of Anderson's, what I would consider his lesser works, like Steve Zissou or Even Fantastic Mr. Fox, which I'm not a real big fan of. This film, to me, really feels alive because of the performers.
And so the influences, though, it sounds like for you, although more obvious maybe, were in a way freeing. Because as you were continuing to tick off influences, after I had ticked off influences, it started to strike me as this can be the sign of a director who's run out of ideas. So they start rehashing in their own way
Right. Previous
films. But I didn't find it to be that at all. I did find it to have those influences more laid more bare for me than other Anderson films.
Mm-hmm.
It felt in some ways less his own, but not to its detriment. Because I think one of the themes of this picture is this idea of nostalgia for the past of many kinds. In the film specifically, it's the Fiennes character's nostalgia for an age of refinement, of tradition that's coming to an end partly because of his age, certainly because of his patrons' ages. One of them dies early on. And also this impending war is going to change these traditions drastically.
Right.
And this seems to be something Anderson, this idea of nostalgia is something that's imbued in Anderson's work. And it's also an idea that he's interested in. But look at what he plays with. You mentioned it, stop motion. He has a nostalgia for earlier types of filmmaking craft
Yep. That
he continues through this day. And I think seeing those two things married for me here in Grand Budapest was really thrilling to see him explore them both in theme and in practice. You mentioned that downhill ski chase. What I love about the fact is not how intricately – being a stop-motion fan, I just love that it's stop-motion.
Mm-hmm,
and it's intricately done and so imaginative. But I like how he combines it with the live action so that you never question – it's not jarring in an Anderson film in a way that it really should be. It should be completely jarring to go from a close-up of Ralph Fiennes and Tony Revolori, who plays this lobby boy that becomes the Fiennes character's companion, to go from a live-action shot of them on a sled and then all of a sudden this miniature stop-motion of them, and you buy it. You're completely in on this film.
Yeah.
And I think what Anderson has done is worked with his team to create the analogy I'm going to go with. I mentioned the layer cake. I think another one is the snow globe analogy.
Hmm.
He has created this enclosed magic that you buy whatever's taking place within this film. There's a scene where Gustav is in jail and it starts snowing inside the jail. And I didn't even blink at it because at that point, it was part of this world.
Yeah.
And that can feel claustrophobic. That's a charge that people make of Anderson's films, is that these fussy worlds he creates can feel, make the viewer feel hemmed in. I tend to feel the opposite, that they're incredibly freeing.
Hmm.
And that was the case here for Grand Budapest as well.
Well, back to work.
Mr. Gustav.
Yes?
Me and the boys talked it over. We think you're a real straight fellow.
Well, I've never been accused of that before, but I appreciate the sentiment.
You're one of us now.
What a lovely thing to say. Thank you, dear Pinky. Thank you, Gunter. Thank you, Wolf. Anything else?
Tell him, Ludwig.
Checkpoint 19 ain't no two-bit hooskow. You got broad-gauge iron bars on every door, vent, and window. You got 72 guards on the floor and 60 more in the towers. You got a 325-foot drop into a moat full of crocodiles. But like the best of them, it's got a soft spot, which in this case happens to take the form of a storm-drained sewer system, dating from the time of the original rock fortification way back in the Middle Ages. Now, nobody's saying it's a stroll down a tree-lined promenade with the fine lady in the white poodle, but it's got what you'd call vulnerability. And that's our bread and butter. Take a look.
This is the thing. You know, I think half the audience is going to go with this peculiar and very delicate mashup. You know, it's the only time I've ever used the words delicate and mashup in the same sentence. But this is kind of the idea of this film. And there's plenty of deliberate and, in some ways, kind of cheap anachronisms where you have in the middle of this fictional Eastern European province, you have Harvey Keitel, who's not hiding the Brooklynese at all, saying things like, let's blow. And, you know, when he's trying to break out of prison with the Ralph Fiennes character. So we're not talking about if we buy it realistically. You're not – Anderson's working in a series – he's never gone for realism. It's a kind of heightened realism or stylized, whatever you want to say. It's got kind of a flat storybook image quality and a very, as I said, very specific set of visual vocabulary words or methods that he uses. But I think in this one, because Ralph Fiennes is in the middle of it and he had this very deft, high comic farceur activating scenes and finding the right performance style to match the visual style, this film is not strictly a visual experience. It's actually, you can just delight in the performance of it. And there's something from the last book that Zweig, the influence, the primary influence here on Grand Budapest Hotel, Stefan Zweig's last story was called Chess Story. And in it, he's writing about a chess master who's dedicating himself to just this one pursuit his entire life. And here's what Zweig wrote. The more one limits oneself, the closer one is to the infinite. These people, as unworldly as they seem, burrow like termites into their own particular material to construct in miniature a strange and utterly individual image of the world. I mean, does that sound like Wes Anderson?
Yes.
So I think it was inevitable that Stefan Zweig was going to meet up with Wes Anderson on some artistic project, even if it was posthumous for Zweig. And here we have it. And I think when I look at the film I've always considered my favorite of Anderson's, Rushmore. And now looking at Grand Budapest Hotel, which is maybe my second favorite of his, yes, the visual vocabulary is very similar in both, but the subject matter is so different that it would be hard to accuse Anderson of staying still and stalling as an artist. I think he's really found a way to keep growing as an artist. And I mean, some films of his I don't buy at all. I know there are films you like, Steve Zissou. I struggle to engage constantly. Fantastic Mr. Fox, even though I like the style, there's something about Mr. Fox I just has struggled with both times I've seen it. Liked it a little better the second time. You know, but these the good work is a real jump up from the ones I don't like. You know, what do you say to the charges of twee or cloying or, you know, that whole thing?
It's just never struck me that way. And it's one of those things, either it is or it's not. It's not something you can argue against. I understand people who would react to it. And certainly he gives ammunition to those who will pick up on details, whether it's the type of clothing or lines of dialogue that are repeated, or types of speaking the dialogue, I should say, that are repeated from film to film. He gives them a lot of ammunition by continuing to do that. Hmm. But I don't feel that it's ever treading water either. And if we're ranking, I'd actually rank both Fantastic Mr. Fox and Zissou ahead of Grand Budapest. I'm not quite sure why
really?
Yet. I think one of the things, and maybe we can get to one element of this film, one of the things is the way the women characters are interwoven into both Zissou and Mr. Fox that are much more integral to the plot and enrich the story and the film itself in a way that I see Grand Budapest wanting to do. And it's one of these cases where if he hadn't had that element at all, it might not have bothered me. But the fact that he does have this Saoirse Ronan character, Agatha, just here or there enough for us to really want more of her.
To be frustrated by it.
She does play a baker's assistant in the town near the hotel. And the young actor Tony Revolori's character, Zero, the lobby boy, these two begin a romance, one that Gustave amusingly encourages, gets in the middle of a little bit. He's constantly being accused of flirting with her. And there is a lot of human connection there, that the potential for human connection, should I say. And Anderson's films don't have to push that very far. This one felt like it didn't quite push it far enough.
Yeah, the one charge I might level at Anderson a little bit is that there's a certain, I mean, a lot of male filmmakers can be accused of kind of arrested adolescence well into middle age. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure Anderson's necessarily there, but he does have a way of focusing on certain themes over and over. You know, usually the resentment towards one's father. There's usually kind of surrogate father-son or brother relationships or actual brother relationships at the center of his films. Yeah, he's not particularly strong on women. Which is also one of the reasons I did like Moonrise Kingdom, because I thought that was a more even-handed, egalitarian, and equally fictitious vision of the universe. And that it takes place on this fictitious island, New Penzance, off the coast of New England. And, you know, that's just as fanciful and far away and never-never-land as Zabrowka here in Grand Budapest Hotel. But, yeah, that limits it. But somehow, the other thing that really occurs to me seeing this, Josh, and I'd like to see it a second time, is there's something about Anderson's style or styles that fits very well in an arch, brittle period piece. And he hasn't really made – he's set films in all kinds of periods, but this is the most aggressively far, far away he's ever done a movie. And the most blatant in its referencing of other past great directors like Lubitsch and others. But – that style fits that sort of impulse. And I think maybe if you get a little tired of what Anderson's up to visually in modern day or contemporary settings, it, somehow it all kind of slips into a more convincing milieu when you look at it through the prism of the movie's version of 30s Hollywood.
I'm not leaving.
I beg your pardon?
I'm not leaving.
Why not?
I'm frightened.
Of what?
I fear this may be the last time we ever see each other.
Why on earth would that be the case?
Well, I can't put it into words, but I feel it.
Well, for goodness sake, there's no reason for you to leave us if you'd rather...
Come with me.
To f*** Lutz.
Please.
Give me your hand.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson, joined by the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips to discuss Wes Anderson's latest picture, The Grand Budapest Hotel. And we touched on it, but I think we need to give it a lot more time because to me, it was maybe the best thing about the film, and that's Ralph Fiennes' lead performance as the concierge, Gustav. I loved how he played the scene. In some sense, it made me think he was playing it as a movie director when he goes through the hotel and is issuing commands to his staff, you know, four in a row. But the other thing that's wonderful about it is in between each command to his staff, which he gives that's a little brisk and you know, has a hint of a threat behind it, he'll turn to a hotel guest and bat his eyelashes and give this flowery, you know, hello. So he's playing both sides there.
He's a fantastic technician, he finds. And you see it
at work here. It reminded me of a maitre d', the way he's servicing himself as well through every one of his actions. He's not just servicing the hotel's guests. He's very much has himself in mind. It's like a maitre d' who's ushering himself to the best table in the house.
Right.
He saved it for himself. And the way he ends so many of his flowery, eloquent speeches with just the right swear word is absolutely perfect because it's funny, but it also hints at this other baser side of him that he's willing to give into. And it made me think, has any other filmmaker, there are a handful, here are the ones who come to mind, who use swearing so precisely and so funnily as Anderson. I think of Scorsese, of course. I think of Tarantino. But the amount of times where foul language is used in films just as filler.
Yeah.
But Anderson's characters put those words precisely where they need to be, surprisingly. And Fiennes does that so much
here. I might argue the other side of that one. I did read one after I wrote the review of Budapest myself. I looked at a couple others, and I honestly forget who wrote this, but somebody said, you know, it's the movie's limitation is its verbal wit. From their point of view, everything about the look of the film and everything about the performance level and the skill that Fiennes is sort of evincing in every single line reading and everything is kind of elevating the verbal repartee itself. And I think I understand, I think I agree with some of that limitation in that some of the deliberate anachronisms, which is different than just using vulgarity, you know, I think to me throw me out a little bit, and some of that is related to the quote bad language in it. But when you have somebody like Fiennes tossing it off,
he just sold everyone.
Oh,
for
everyone!
Me.
No, he's great, and you never really know which actor is going to figure out a Wes Anderson movie.
Mm-hmm.
Moonrise Kingdom, it wasn't necessarily the key performance, but Edward Norton, I think that was his first time working with Anderson in Moonrise Kingdom as the Scoutmaster. And there's something about the precision and the economy and the wit that a guy like Edward Norton kind of brings to everything he does made perfect sense for Moonrise Kingdom. And that's he just knows how to behave in one of his movies. Mathieu Amalric, the French actor, is wonderful.
Yeah, he's great here.
Plays a minor role in the Grand Budapest Hotel, is wonderful. I mean, he just looks – he knows how to act this sort of heightened storybook fakery. And the movie is a series of fakeries. It's all – you know, it's that's what it is. And some people figure it out and some don't. And Fiennes is just having a – and it is wonderful to see Ralph Fiennes – having a good time because so often in his career, Josh, you know, I've admired him for years in a lot of things, but he's taken on a relentless series of glum roles.
Yeah, you think of him as a dour performer overall.
Yeah.
I do. Not in a bad way. That's just sort of the persona of the parts he's playing,
least. English Pace, I was supposed to be the one that would cement it for most people.
Uh-huh.
Which a film I like very much, actually, but you know, you even see it in The Invisible Woman, the film that Fiennes directed recently in which he plays Charles Dickens. There's a wonderful introductory scene in that film where he's – first time we've seen Fiennes on screen and as Dickens, and he's just introducing a character to the members of his company and his family. And it's just a wonderful 5 minutes that that kind of reminds us what fun Fiennes can be when his role calls for it and allows for it. And in Grand Budapest Hotel, it allows for it every second. And thank God, because he just buoys the entire experience.
Well, I talked a little bit about this concern of nostalgia that I really appreciated in the film. And I think, you know, when I think about it, it's a comedy for sure, but it's almost a comedy about the tragedy of nostalgia, how that can only take you so far and it's always going to leave you sad in the end in some way. And one of the technical elements that reflects that is the various aspect ratios that Anderson and his cinematographer, Bob Uman, are working with here. And the predominant one, they're sort of tied to the period, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely.
Of what the narrative is.
Right.
So we go from, you know, the widescreen of present day. The predominant ratio we get is the Academy ratio, which is best described as boxy, and that's for the 1932 scenes.
Right. That's the 1:37 ratio. That's in the 30s scenes. And then in the 60s scenes, that's actually the widescreen 240, which is ironic because you're not getting sweeping Lawrence of Arabia vistas. You're just getting the most decrepit version of the hotel
right.
after it's kind of gone to seed.
A little Shining-ish there,
yeah,
the hotel from The Shining, yeah.
And then you get the 70s bits bookending the whole thing that are shot in 185. And yet, you know, it's not a big stunt. These are not frivolous decisions to shoot it in three different ratios, and they don't hit you over the head with them. I mean, these are all interpolated very elegantly, and again, it would all seem like just a series of gimmicks or tricks if there weren't any kind of movie to hang this on. But there is a movie to hang it on.
Yeah, and what I liked about the Academy ratio particularly is not only the idea of nostalgia, but you get a lot of visual gags out of that box.
Right.
There's one in particular with a prison yard, and it involves two doors, one on screen and one off screen that we don't see. And there's another one involving a ladder. And in both of those jokes, it has very much to do with the vast amount of space in that ratio that's off screen
right.
That we're aware of. So they're making very appropriate use of the various ratios here.
Well, I think that ladder bit too, there's also another gag within that as this immensely long ladder is being sort of like whizzed up from floor to floor to floor, it looks like a real film. It looks like film images kind mm-hmm. of in the old film stock. And mm-hmm. And this film was shot largely on old film stock. It's not, you know, there is some digital work in it, and God knows it's plenty of, you know, 21st century technology behind the Grand Budapest Hotel. But as you say, Anderson is in love with the machinery and the fakery of the old days. And it does fold into what the writer Stefan Zweig, you know, the primary influence here, was writing about, which is just this sort of, it's not sentimentalized nostalgia, but it's elusive. You know, I mean, the way Zweig was remembering what his life was like in Vienna, and as it got darker and darker throughout the 20th century, and he became an exile. And this theme of exile is also in the film, in that Zero, the lobby boy,
exactly,
reveals himself, and it's not a big plot reveal, but it reveals himself at one point. He reminds Gustav, after kind of a harsh word or two, that, you know, he's not here because he wants to be. He's a refugee. And this is lightly handled, but it does stick. And I think the film's got just enough seriousness in it so that it all doesn't completely evaporate into frivolity or just production design.
Well, the Grand Budapest Hotel is currently in limited release. I think it's been out in some cities for 2 weeks now. So hopefully some of you have had a chance to see it and can weigh in with your thoughts. We'd love to get those via email. You can send those to us at feedback@filmspotting.net. Voicemails are always appreciated. 312-264-0744. And of course, we are on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
We'll check out of the Grand Budapest and into another movie hotel when we play Massacre Theater next. Then we'll slip into our yellow jumpsuits for a look at Wes Anderson's best scenes.
I look like a little banana.
The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
I don't do too much talking these days. These days I seem to think a lot about the things that I forgot to do. And all the times I had the chance to. I start. up my rambling. I don't do too much gambling these days.
Quick interruption here, folks, so we can remind you that Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM3. We're also brought to you by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. Whether it's your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or another film project, Shutterstock has over 1 million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. They have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most do come in HD. When I was looking on Shutterstock for hotel images, Michael, thinking of the Grand Budapest Hotel, of course, I found more than 3,000, actually, and one of the first to come up was a picture of an elegant concierge bell, much more sophisticated than the one we used as a prop for Masquer Theater.
I think it came from a microtel.
I think you're right.
Shutterstock sources video clips from around the world and puts them at your fingertips. Many contributors to Shutterstock are professional filmmakers. Each video is reviewed individually for content and quality before adding it to its library. And Shutterstock adds 12,000 video clips each week. So every time you visit, you'll find something new. Shutterstock gives you the assets you need to bring your creative projects to the next level.
Shutterstock does have flexible pricing, so you can choose between individual clips or video packs. You can download clips in HD, or you can save with standard definition or web formats. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. No credit card is needed. Just start an account, begin using Shutterstock, and save video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM314, and new accounts will receive 25% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 25% off new accounts, use offer code FILM314. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
I had a lover. I don't think I risk another these days.
Hi, Josh and Adam. This is Scott Tobias of The Dissolve. Wanted to talk a little bit about Alan Rene. You know, the day he died, friend of the show Peter Labuza made the great observation on Twitter that his first films felt like the work of an old master, and his last films felt like the work of a youthful filmmaker, which I think is exactly right. If you didn't know better, you'd think that he would have started his career with something like Wild Grass, which is from 2009, which is a very bright, sort of deceptively bright romantic comedy with one of the craziest endings I can remember. And then he might have ended his career with something with Hiroshima Mon Amour, Night and Fog, last year Marion Bad, you know, his sort of established early classics. He was a director who liked to use film to dabble in other disciplines like theater and literature, but the common thread was always his genius with structure. He liked to pick apart and experiment with how stories get told, and he always found fresh and innovative ways to do it. Of all of his films, however, the one that really sticks with me is 1977's Providence, an English-language film he did with John Gielgud as a bedridden writer who's working on a story based on his relatives. It's a bitterly funny film about a man whose point of view completely distorts reality, which is a phenomenon Rene understood better than anyone. All right, guys, thanks.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips. I'm Josh Larson, and you just heard from Scott Tobias from The Dissolve, helping us out here with a little tribute to Alain René. The 91-year-old René passed away March 1st, and he was best known for his films Hiroshima Mon Amour, that's from 1959. It was his feature debut, also starred Emmanuel Riva. His follow-up was 1961's Last Year at Marion Bad. René's latest film, Life of Riley, just premiered in February at this year's Berlin International Film Festival, where it was awarded the Alfred Bauer Prize there.
So, as Scott mentioned, there's an awful lot of work coming in from different mediums for René and all sorts of disparate influences from other art forms. This is like any filmmaker. You know, nobody works in a vacuum, even Wes Anderson. And René's career has frankly kind of been a puzzlement to me in a way, because he's spent an awful lot of time in the last 10, 15 years working on, in the end, you know, several different Alan Ayckbourn comedies. And that would seem to be a very odd coupling of kind of middle brow British, you know, very dark farces, but, you know, kind of discordant marital comedies. And René's, you know, very different sensibility. But Those are films that kind of vexed me when I first saw them, like Private Fears and Public Places. But there's something very beguiling about the style of those films. And I'm eager to see this last one, Life of Riley, just to see him working again with a lot of the members of his stock company who he's dealt with over the decades. This is a long, long way, Josh, from the films you mentioned, Hiroshima, Monomoy, and Marienbad, in that you're not dealing with these sort of 10-ton cryptic puzzles. Mm. You know, these are much lighter. They're not just confections, because there's sort of a strange undercurrent to them. But you know, he's a filmmaker I don't know well enough. There's an awful lot of the middle period I don't know as well as I should. And yeah, it would be a great candidate for serious exploration. And you know, it's just a shame to have to do it now that he's gone.
Well, cryptic puzzle, that certainly applies to Last Year at Marienbad, which I was watching last night. And when Scott talks about his genius with structure, man, is that evident there. It's like all the puzzle pieces, trying to put together a puzzle, but the pieces keep changing shape on you. That's the one where a man meets a woman at this sort of gloomy, creepy, but very ornate hotel and tries to convince her they met a year earlier and had this affair, and she denies it. And the way you move around in time and space there so elegantly, so imperceptibly, almost you never quite know with each cut, with each line of dialogue, where you're going to be next, and it takes you a second to position yourself. Yet it's done with such elegance and grace that you don't feel tricked. You don't feel like something's being pulled out from under you at all.
Yeah, it depends when you see it and maybe at what point in your life you come back to it. Because I've been a little maddened by that movie, depending on when in my life I've given it a shot. It seems a little not truly dreamlike or nightmarish to me. It seems more diagrammed or programmed than that. And I like movies that take on kind of a subconscious life of their own. And that film is too... Maybe, as you say, it's too much of a kind of a chess game.
It was nightmarish for me. That's the word that came to mind. It definitely cast that spell. And I think it probably is one of those ones. If you have to be in the right mindset to engage it. And if you hit it on an off night or an off afternoon, I could see how you would be at a distance from it.
Right. Yeah. But I can't wait to see. I mean, I've seen one of the few from what I guess you call is kind of late middle period, Providence from 1977 with John Gielgud, who's fantastic in it.
The one Scott mentions, right?
Right, and Elaine Stritch, among other people. That film is, you know, I don't know if it's a major work from him, but it's just not like anybody else's drawing room sort of comedy dramas. It's not, you know, labels don't really apply to René. He's a very fluid boundary jumper, and that's one of the great things about him.
Well, Adam and I both need to see a lot more of his work, so he is on the list for a future film spotting marathon. That's going to be down the road, though. Right now, it's time for Massacre Theater.
In the spirit of Elaine René.
Exactly.
We're going to perform a scene, and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Josh and Adam massacred this scene.
Ma'am? Is there something I can do for you?
Do you have anything to eat? I'm bloody starving. It took 6 hours to get up here in that flipping contraption.
Well, you have to forgive me. My kitchen ain't in operation yet, but, I could take you up to the restaurant up there if you're hungry enough.
I'm hungry enough. I could eat a bloody horse.
Well, Sheehan's place, you probably will.
On the frontier wit, I see.
That was Julie Christie as Mrs. Miller and Warren Beatty as McCabe in McCabe and Mrs. Miller from 1971. It was directed by Robert Altman and written by Altman along with Brian McKay. I have to say, I was pretty proud of my British accent in that performance, Michael, and Adam even complimented it, which is rare, but apparently others weren't so fond of it. One listener on Twitter asked me never, ever to do a British accent again. It just crushed me. Crushed me. Here I thought I was at the top of my game.
Top of your game. Well, you know, the Brits can do all sorts of American dialects. And
doesn't always go the other way around.
I'm not sure we're on a fair exchange there.
Well, if you want to weigh in on my accent, you can hear that scene, plus our Sacred Cow review of Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles, which does celebrate its 40th anniversary this year. That's episode number 479. Also on that show, we did share our pre-Oscar picks with Kyle Buchanan from New York Magazine's Vulture. You can find episode 479 on iTunes or at filmspotting.net. All right, Michael, we did not get a ton of entries, so perhaps more evidence that my accent was terrible, but we got enough that we can pick out a winner this week. Michael, you want to do the honors and go ahead and reach into the film spotting hat?
I'd be honored. Actually, I'd be privileged.
Wonderful.
It's Sam Birchman, Seattle, Washington. Congratulations, Sam. Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your film spotting t-shirt.
What happened to the cannoli line, Max? You're supposed to say forget about it, Sanchez. The old man likes his cannoli.
Look, I made a mistake, all right? It didn't make any difference anyway.
Hey, I'm letting it go. But don't say it doesn't matter. Every line matters.
All right, for this week's Massacre Theater, you may not recognize the film right away, but the tie-in is definitely going to be pretty obvious. And we have changed a couple of the names in the scene because otherwise we would have given away the title of the movie. And yes, that is another hint. So this might be one of the easier Massacre Theaters. Michael, we not only have the two of us, we have a prop as well to provide some audio effects here. I think that's going to put this scene over the top.
Did it come from your home?
Yes.
The prop did.
I had to raid my kids' board game stockpile to find this particular prop, and I think it'll work just fine.
Okay.
Let's give it a try. I'm going to start out. Actually, the prop is going to start out.
Is it a Twister sheet? Is it like?
No, not Twister. You're close. Okay. We'll. I don't want to give too much away.
Is it the little prop. Cannon in Monopoly?
You've got it.
All right. Let's go.
All right. Why don't you give me the action?
Okay. And action.
Welcome to the Hotel Bryant. May I help you, sir?
I'm checking in. Jesus Quintana.
All righty. Okay. Quintana. Quintana. Jesus. That must be you, huh?
Must be.
Okay, then. Everything seems to be in order. Are you a trans or a res?
Excuse me?
Transient or resident?
I don't know. I mean, I'll be here indefinitely.
And?
Scene.
Wonderful.
I was trying to bring kind of an opaque ambiguity or an ambiguous opaqueness.
You didn't quite want to be there. I picked that up. If you know that scene, just go ahead and email the title along with the name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. A little extra time here. Our deadline is going to be Monday, March 24.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Quick note here about the music in this week's show. It's coming from the soundtrack to the Royal Tenenbaums. We've heard Nico's These Days and Judy is a Punk by the Ramones. As listener Jack from Chicago wrote to us earlier this week, something needs to be said for a rock and roll movie soundtrack. Where else can you hear the Ramones, Paul Simon, and a Charlie Brown Christmas all in the audio fabric of one film? I'm sure, Michael, as we get into our top five Wes Anderson scenes, we'll talk about the music as well.
The three Tenenbaum children performed Margot's first play on the night of her 11th birthday. They had agreed to invite their father to the party.
What'd you think, Dad?
Didn't seem believable to me. Why are you wearing pajamas? Do you live here?
He has permission to sleep over.
Well, did you at least think the characters were well-developed?
What characters? There's a bunch of little kids dressed up in the animal costumes.
Good night, everyone.
Well, sweetie, don't be mad at me. That's just one man's opinion.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
That was Gene Hackman's Royal Tenenbaum from the opening prologue of Wes Anderson's The Royal Tenenbaums from 2001. And Michael, that's how I critique all of my 11-year-old daughter's artwork. I just say it's not believable. No. You know, I find that's been very fruitful and good for her mental health.
That's good. Yeah. She'll win a Pulitzer out of sheer spite.
That's my hope.
Yeah.
Well, before we get into our top five Anderson scenes, let's see how our Anderson-themed film spotting poll question played out. Last week, we did ask you to name, very simply here, what's your favorite Wes Anderson film? We did not include The Grand Budapest Hotel, as it was just in limited release at that point. So, considering his seven previous features, which one did listeners like the most? Michael, what were the results?
Okay, number one, the from least to most.
We're going to go from least to most. It looks like we have a tie here at the bottom.
I know, yeah. The equal dislike or disinterest in Bottle Rocket at 3% of the vote and the Darjeeling Limited at 3% of the vote. Next came The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou at 10% of the vote.
That's the one I most often hear people say they dislike, so yeah. I'm surprised not to see that in last,
I'm afraid I'm with the majority.
You are, yeah. I love that one.
Fantastic Mr. Fox, the stop-motion animation feature, just ahead of that with 12% of the vote. Then Moonrise Kingdom with 19%. That was Anderson's biggest commercial success to date. Rushmore with 25% of the vote, and just beating out Rushmore for favorite is The Royal Tenenbaums.
Oh, so close.
26% of the vote.
And Rushmore was your pick. And my pick, yep. But beat out by Royal Tenenbaums. I'm okay with that. I adore Royal Tenenbaums. as well. It'll be interesting to see. You mentioned how Moonrise Kingdom was a hit. As the years go on, if that one will inch its way towards the top of people's favorites of his films, because there's an emotional connection to that one people have that I think is only going to grow over time.
Right.
Christopher Reese from Lexington, Kentucky wrote in to say, this one was easy, easy. It has to be Royal Tenenbaums. For Gene Hackman alone, if nothing else, and there is much else. I recognize that if you step back from it, there may not be a whole lot here, a potential issue with all of Anderson's films. But the spell this one casts is so compelling that it does not matter. For me, this will always be the definitive Anderson film.
Matt Watkins wrote, I figured that the Royal Tenenbaums will likely win this poll, and I have no issue with the love for that film. It is wonderful. But for me, it was between Rushmore and The Life Aquatic. Rushmore was the first Wes Anderson film I saw, and I thought it was brilliant then and on multiple viewings since. However, my vote goes to The Life Aquatic because I think it showcases what I most love about Anderson's characters, style, and humor. From Bill Murray complaining about the leeches, nobody else got hit? What, I'm the only one? What's the deal? To William Dafoe's pouting Klaus, to the cross-section shot of the ship. I love this movie.
I'm with you, Matt, especially Willem Dafoe's Klaus. Also heard from Jen Small of Chicago. Moonrise Kingdom for me, she says. Already a Wes Anderson fan, I instantly fell in love with this movie when it came out. Somehow having the protagonists be kids anchored the fairy tale nature of his work more than in any of his previous films. And it all has the feel of sweet memories tinted with melancholy like old Polaroids yellowed with age.
Beautifully put.
That's wonderful, Jen. Let's get then to our top five Wes Anderson scenes here on the occasion of his latest film, The Grand Budapest Hotel. Michael, this was one where, for me, probably 20 scenes instantaneously come to mind. He's just one of my favorite working filmmakers.
Oh, wow.
So it was a really difficult list to whittle down. What sort of process was it for you? Did you have those same lines of dialogue or scenes that came to mind, or was it more a matter of revisiting things to see what really were worthy of inclusion?
I saw a lot of stuff for the second time.
Okay.
And in fact, I saw Bottle Rocket for the first time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a great excuse to actually get completely hipped to one filmmaker's work, essentially. And it's not so much, I think I have a different relationship to his work than you do. I think it's not, for me, it's not like, oh yeah, I got to have that scene or this scene or that moment. But there's certain kind of ideas or emblems about what he's about that I wanted to cover in five different ways, just because I think they're important to him, and therefore to the degree I do admire him, which is pretty, not as much as you, but I admire him a great deal. And the movies I like his, I really like. I just wanted to kind of cover the bases on that.
So, all right. Yeah. Sounds good. So what do you have then at number five?
So number five is a scene. There's a scene in Bottle Rocket, the first feature that came out of a 1992 short film of the same name by Anderson, where Luke and Owen Wilson are playing friends who are burglarizing the home of the Luke Wilson character, who's right. Now, you know, basically revisiting his boyhood home. And, you know, they're ransacking the place when it's empty, going for the coin collection where they know where it is and they know they can get some money.
It's a practice burglary.
It's a practice burglary for other jobs to come. And in the feature version in Bottle Rocket, there's a moment that is not in the short film where Luke Wilson is taking stuff off this and that desk, and he sees kind of his own collection. I believe it's his own collection of toy soldiers, and one of them's out of place slightly. So he actually pauses mid-burglary to straighten out the front soldier in this collection. And to me, that is emblematic of the way Anderson works as a filmmaker, because everything is about arrangement.
Yes.
and this sort of... you know, there's almost like a stamp collecting quality to his work, because you don't regard stamp design as a casual or, you know, sort of slapdash endeavor. And I don't regard Wes Anderson's film as anything. There's very little casual and slapdash about it. What's curious about Bottle Rocket, Josh, is that it's not as fiercely stylized as his later work. So there is kind of a more seemingly casual, kind of spontaneous air to the compositions and to the energy of the thing. Although, in other ways, a lot of what he's into was right there from the beginning. But at that moment in Bottle Rocket, to me, is pointing the direction of where this filmmaker is going. And it is, you know, he is the American king of mise-en-scène.
Now, I do love that moment, too. And it makes me think, when you talk about Anderson being a precise filmmaker, which people often do, as Adam and I talked about the Lego movie, trying to put people in two different camps. The person who builds completely according to directions, or just dumps them on the floor and creates something new, you would think Anderson is probably that precise person who wants everything in order, but maybe not. As his films have blossomed, you wonder if maybe he is that creative guy. But at the end, what you get is this sort of precise universe. Mm-hmm. Very nice pick. My number five is going to come from Fantastic Mr. Fox, and it's the salute to the wolf near the end. Fantastic Mr. Fox is, of course, Anderson's 2009 stop-motion triumph about this risk-taking fox who runs into trouble with three greedy farmers. It's just a wonder of a film for me, an adaptation of a Roald Dahl book, who's one of my favorite children's authors. I love stop-motion, so it hits me right there, especially when it's done uniquely. I mean, no other stop-motion work looks quite like this. Maybe the Rankin-Bass TV work is the most similar, but in current animation, it was very unique. Now, after Mr. Fox, who's voiced by George Clooney, has escaped from the farmers with Kylie Ash and Christofferson, they're on the road on this motorcycle, they spot a wolf off in the distance while they're driving.
Where'd he come from? Where'd you come from? What are you doing here? Canis lupus. Vulpes bulpus. I don't think he speaks English or Latin. Pensez-vous que l'hiver sera rude? I'm asking if he thinks we're in for a hard winter.
Now, as Foxy confesses here, and he has earlier in the film too, he has a phobia of wolves, but it's really a mixture of fear and jealousy because the wolf represents this lone freedom that he sought for much of the film. It's what he wants to achieve until he realizes that pursuing it is going to put his family, really his whole community, at great risk. This contrast of the wolf with Mr. Fox is wonderfully realized in how the wolf is visually depicted by the puppeteers here. He's much different than all the other animal puppets in this film. He walks on all fours, for one thing. He isn't dressed. He doesn't talk at all. I mean, he's wild. This is the wildest creature in the movie. And Fox's teary salute, which the wolf returns, a great touch there, it's part awe. He says, what a beautiful creature. And it's also this mournful goodbye to his own wild past as he's going to embrace now this, for better or worse, new domesticity.
Yes.
So Fantastic Mr. Fox gets my number five slot. How about your number four, Michael?
My number four is, I can't really go on without questioning the word triumph to describe Fantastic Mr.
Oh,
Fox.
Oh, such a triumph of the animated art form.
I'll try it again. I'll try it a third time someday. My number four is actually a scene that's like many scenes in Moonrise Kingdom and many scenes in Anderson's work as a whole. It's the Edward Norton Scoutmaster scene where he's kind of breaking in the scout troops on the plan to kind of bring about a nonviolent resolution to the escape of the protagonist, the young protagonist who's run off to meet with his newfound girlfriend on the other side of the island.
You have your orders. Use the orienteering and pathfinding skills that you've been practicing all summer. Let's find our man, bring him safely back to camp. Remember, this isn't just a search party. It's a chance to do some first-class scouting. Any questions? Lazy Eye.
What's your real job, sir?
I'm a math teacher. Why?
What grade?
Eighth.
Any PhD for that?
Lazy Eye, no. But you know what? We're actually in the middle of something here, in case you didn't notice. One of our scouts is missing, and that's a crisis. Anybody else? Redford.
What if he resists?
And it's just a series of tracking shots that we see a lot in Anderson's work. In this case, it's alongside the characters, not in front mostly, but throughout the film, the Norton character is seen as kind of the barreling through, often from, you know, the tracking shot will kind of lead him forward. Often it just sort of tracks alongside. And it works for a lot of reasons, I think. Norton just turns out to be exactly the right actor to match what Anderson's doing visually. He works, as we said earlier, with extreme economy and concision, and he doesn't sort of storybook up the quality of the acting. Some people just sort of have a little too much fun with it or not enough fun with the material when they're in a Wes Anderson film because they think, oh, it's all kind of fanciful, make-believe storybook. He's playing it very realistically and kind of low-key, and that's the key to the style, I think. There's a deadpan, low-key quality to Anderson's work that has to be complemented by the performance or it just ends up kind of drying out the experience. But that shot, you know, I love tracking shots anyway, Josh. I just like cameras that move. I generally don't like cameras that move in as regimented a fashion as Anderson's do because there's a half a dozen or 10 different visual strategies, the swish pan where you're sort of focusing on one person, then the camera pivots maybe 45 or 90 degrees whoosh, to catch the reaction and then whoosh, back to the reaction to the reaction. You know, that's in every film practically. But Anderson's enough of a master at his own particular vocabulary visually that he knows how to make that work and tell the story and keep it moving. And, you know, for those of us who don't like the typical over-the-shoulder dun-dun-dun-dun TV technique or bad film technique, this is, you know, those tracking shots are a major component to why his films give delight. And this is one of them.
Well, you've made a good case for Norton here, and I know you've done it before, but I've got to say, as much as I love that character in Moonrise Kingdom, I've always tripped up over Norton in the film a little bit, and I was similarly tripped up in the Grand Budapest Hotel as the police captain or police chief.
He's a little less effective in that one.
Okay, there's just something, and watching Moonrise again recently, it still bothered me. He forces the patter of the dialogue in a way that even, and I know we're on the opposite ends of this too, someone like Bruce Willis in Moonrise, I find, doesn't even try.
He doesn't change anything.
I'd almost rather have that than Norton sort of trying to hit those beats but being just a quarter of a second off.
Yeah, I didn't experience it the same way. I mean, I understand what you're saying about Willis.
It might just be how we're responding to the way they're trying to put their personalities into Anderson's style.
Okay, and this is a key, I think, why Gene Hackman is so effective in Royal Tenenbaums, because Hackman is not a guy who, and this is, you know, Anderson, when I interviewed him at Cannes a couple of years ago for Moonrise, he talked about having real troubles with Hackman on the set. And, you know, and Anderson's kind of an anal retentive guy. He likes to give line readings. He likes to be insanely precise with the blocking so the actors aren't just sort of vaguely hitting a mark.
Right.
They're really, really hitting a prescribed mark. And, you know, something about Hackman's technique and his years and the rest of it was kind of like, the hell with this,
right,
you know.
Sure.
But what the results in Royal Tenenbaums, perfect.
Oh, brilliant.
Hackman has a way of enlivening and loosening up a very prescribed sort of attack, and, you know, works wonderfully in it. And Fiennes in Grand Budapest, it's not the same thing because he's a very, very highly technical, classically trained actor, but, you know, he just sort of loosens it up in another way. But you need somebody to do that, or else the movies would dry out.
My number four also comes from Moonrise Kingdom. Now, in this movie, it isn't really until the two teen runaways, played by Jared Gilman and Kara Hayward, have already taken off that we get a flashback to how they met the previous summer. And that took place at a local church performance of Benjamin Britten's musical version of the Noah story. She's playing a raven there, and he's attending as a khaki scout. Talk about Anderson's camera, and I don't know how this tracking shot works for you, because it is very regimented. It begins going along a church pew, and we see these attentive khakis until we almost bump into Sam, the Gilman character, because he's leaning forward onto the pew in front of him,
right,
looking completely bored. And it's just, this whole sequence is a great example of how Anderson uses the camera to communicate character. So here it nearly bumps into him and his boredom. Then when he becomes so restless that Sam impulsively leaves the sanctuary, it tracks along beside him, even gets unsteady a little bit as a tracking shot when it goes behind him down in the church's basement as he explores what's going on. You mentioned that little touch that Luke Wilson does with the soldier in Bottle Rocket. There are a couple little touches here that are worth highlighting as well, I think. I don't know if these were the actors, Gilman's impulses, or if Anderson encouraged them, but they're great. There's a kid in an elephant mask that he passes. He just sort of grabs the trunk and tests it out for its durability or something. Then he passes a drinking fountain and he tests that too. Doesn't take a drink, just sees if it works. There's also a horror element to this sequence because you've got all these silent kids in the corridors of this church wearing these animal costumes. If you remember this one quick shot of some kid in a hen costume brushing his teeth in a bathroom, it reminded me actually of, it's like a kiddie version of that throwaway shot we've talked about in The Shining with the man and the dog bear doing whatever they're doing in the hotel. It's like you just get this subliminal shot of something quite disturbing.
Right.
The scene here does climax when Sam meets Susie, played by Hayward, and her fellow birds. They're getting their makeup on, and the relationship is just locked in right there. He captures that sort of smitten infatuation that can only happen, I think, probably at that age. He pushes the other birds aside and just says, "What kind of bird are you?"
"I'm a sparrow. She's a dove."
"No," I said. "What kind of bird are you?"
"I'm a raven."
"Boys aren't allowed in here."
"I'll be leaving soon." "What happened to your hand?"
"I got hit in the mirror."
"Really? How did that happen?"
I lost my temper at myself.
Anderson's talked about the theatrical quality of so much of his work, and he hasn't done any theater, he said, since the fifth grade. But in so many of his movies, you have scenes where you're staging theatrical productions. I mean, in Rushmore, he's doing stage versions of Serpico. In Moonrise Kingdom, they're doing, as you say, you know, Noah's Flood, all sorts of things. And that's what gives the movies a strange kind of netherworld quality. Not quite cinema, not quite theater, not quite storybook, not quite this, but you add it all up and it really is something else.
Yeah, that production of Noah's Flood in Moonrise Kingdom, I wouldn't mind seeing that myself.
It's probably better than the last three dinner theater things I've seen. Please. We're going to come back with our 3-1 picks, and in honor of Mr. Anderson's visual style, we've installed a dolly track here in the studio for the remainder of the taping. Stay with us.
Hey there, Film Spotting listeners. This is Matt Singer from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast, and on the new episode of SVU, Allison Wilmore and I get involved in a drug cartel deal that works out, you know, really well, as we talk about Ridley Scott's The Counselor.
And inspired by the character played by Michael Fassbender in the film, who's only ever referred to by the label that's also the title, we're going to look at some other films featuring notable unnamed characters that you can stream or rent at home right now. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us on iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, this is Martin McDonough. You're listening to Film Spotting.
I'll tell you one thing, though. You got more grit, fire, and guts than any woman I've ever met. What are you smiling about?
Nothing.
No, what's so funny?
Nothing. Just these little expressions of yours.
I don't know what you're talking about, but I'll take it as a compliment. You're true blue, Ethel. You really are.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips. I'm Josh Larson. That was Gene Hackman with Angelica Houston as the estranged couple at the center of that film. And Michael, I understand that scene is also your number three pick.
It's my number three pick. Yeah, I don't love Royal Tenenbaums like some people do, and it's not one of my top two for Anderson, but it's got so much wonderful stuff in it. It has to be represented, and I love Gene Hackman and Angelica Houston. The motivation's much more conventional for the Hackman character in this scene than in many scenes, and in a lot of Anderson scenes in general. He's just simply trying to re-ingratiate himself with his estranged family and make amends for what a lousy parent he's been. And it's delightfully played and between these two, because the Houston character is beguiled by this guy all over again, even though her better instincts are telling her, do not believe his load of BS. And to see these two performers together, it's just pure joy, really. And there's nothing really flashy going on visually in this moment. It's a kind of a low-key tracking shot that just simply follows the action and lets these actors do what they need to do in about, you know, 45 seconds of time, maybe a minute. It's not a scene that stands out dramatically in any way, but I guess it's that kind of offhandedness and that sort of throwaway quality that it's what keeps Anderson's movies a little bit human. It's not so that it all doesn't become this hyper-regimented, you know, aggressively stylized experience where the human beings get lost in it. Hackman and Houston are wonderful in this.
For sure. Yeah. Houston, the find of Houston for his films, I think, has been crucial, especially in Steve Zissou. I think she's one of the main reasons that works. and also in Darjeeling Limited. Maybe not one of my favorite films, but having just a little bit of her there in a very, very different role than she is in the other pictures. It's great to see her working with him there as well. My number three, I'm going to stick with the Royal Tenenbaums, and it occurs after the chaotic climax. There's the point when Owen Wilson's Eli Cash crashes his car into the Tenenbaum mansion just before Etheline, the Houston character, is about to be remarried. After that has calmed down and everyone's sort of taking a breath, there's this remarkable 2.5 minute crane shot. So the camera's a little more complicated here than in your scene, Michael. It's not just going across, it's going up, down, in and out. And this is all taking place about a quarter of a city block length outside of the mansion. It starts on a priest who's being loaded into the ambulance talking to Bill Murray.
Do you have an alternate?
No.
Ready?
Are there priests on call?
Goes over to Cash giving a police report.
At which point I apparently lost control of the vehicle, smashed into the house, and killed that poor dog.
Then up to the top of the fire truck where we see Gene Hackman's Royal talking to the firefighters.
I think he's part mutt. What kind of papers do you have for it?
And then it's choreographed so that Murray comes around for the next part of this shot. Mm-hmm. So you could just imagine how intricate this has to be in terms of planning. It does encompass, I think I counted about 10 major characters in this film. And this is the kind of picture that has 10 major characters.
Right.
Those all get worked into this in some way. The final bit is one of those great bittersweet Anderson moments that makes this about more than choreography. It's a beautiful light moment of reconciliation between Royal and Ben Stiller's Chaz.
I got your new dog for the boys. I just bought him.
You did?
Sorry I let you down, Chaz. All of you. I've been trying to make it up to you.
What's his name?
Sparkplug.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I've had a rough year, Dad.
I know you have, Chazzy.
I do think this is emblematic of Anderson's style overall, that the camera is going to serve the story even as it's being very active. Also makes room for an emphasis on humor, that little throwaway bit where Luke Wilson in the shot, he has hurt his eye and it's being examined by Seymour Castle's fake doctor. They make time for that little joke. And then that sudden walloping emotion of the moment between Royal and Chaz. I think it's interesting that Chaz gets this little second here because he's a peripheral character, I think, compared to the other Tenenbaum kids. I think that Luke Wilson's character is at the forefront along with Gwyneth Paltrow's Margot. But Chaz gets this 3 or 4 seconds, and it's when he instinctively chokes out, "I've had a rough year, Dad," that you understand he's speaking for the whole family. And for me, that brings the emotional force of the film home. So Royal Tenenbaum's a little bit higher up on my Anderson ranking list, Michael, probably.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, when I look back at some old reviews and when I wrote about Darjeeling Limited, which I like but don't love, I said you wouldn't mind a little more direct expression of an honest emotion now and then. Not that Anderson's cold, but you know, these are characters who let down their guard only occasionally, and Anderson's whole style is about a kind of extreme formalism. You know, that's what it doesn't feel like a documentary. It's not meant to. It's the opposite. And there are times where you just think, you know, let's just cut the crap. But the reason he's an interesting and complicated artist, I think, and the reason that's a good pick, I think, Josh, is you're saying, you know, there's a technician and a creative mind at work visually in a scene like that where he's encompassing all these different tracks of action, all these characters, and yet he knows when to kind of
pare
it away and get in there and kind of nail it down.
Well, what'd you have for your number two?
My number two is just the briefest of throwaway bits from Rushmore, which remains my favorite one of his, at least it does today, where Bill Murray's in the car. He's Herman Bloom, the successful, wealthy businessman who's got two completely aggravating bullies sons going to this private school, Rushmore, and one of them just lips off, and Murray, nobody can. He's got just supernaturally good timing, Bill Murray.
Because there's that pause.
He's driving. He's heard this ridiculous insult. It's this snide little in the backseat.
Did you invite that kid to your party?
Max Fisher.
Come on, Dad. There's going to be girls there. I'd rather die.
Pull your head out of your ass.
Dude,
2-second pause, and then he just starts wailing on him while continuing the drive. And the whole bit takes about 7 seconds. And it could have worked with a different actor. But I think when you go to find your favorites in Wes Anderson, it's not all about what Anderson's up to. It's about what the actors can find. And that's I love that. I love that. And there's moments, Josh, in a lot of Anderson films where you have this shrewdly judged 2-second pause and then something, a comical action of some kind. And there's a great one in Budapest Hotel,
right.
where Ray finds, as Mr. Gustav is basically being cornered by the local police, right, for the authorities for suspected of murder. And, you know, finds, takes a second just to stand there politely and then just turns and starts running. And it's wonderful. And the camera doesn't do anything, because if the camera moved, then it would kill the joke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that moment in Rushmore, as many times as I've seen it, and it's the most viewed film for me of any of Anderson's, it's the one I will laugh out loud very hard every time, even though I know it's coming. There's something maybe about dads losing it in Cars. I talked on last week's show about the National Lampoon's Vacation moment with Chevy Chase losing it with his family. So maybe it's that for me, but Murray's timing, you're right, in that scene is absolutely hysterical. Well, I think we are bringing an Anderson level of precision to our matching of our picks here, Michael, even though we didn't plan it this way.
What do you have for number two?
My number two is a Bill Murray moment from Rushmore.
Beautiful.
Not in the car. It's actually his cannonball. There are so many to pick from for me from Rushmore, because it is my favorite Anderson film. But I love how this is an example of wordless storytelling that he occasionally uses. It communicates everything we need to know about the misery of Herman Bloom, this businessman who does come to befriend Jason Schwartzman's precocious academy kid. First see him sitting there alone by the pool in the midst of his obnoxious kid's birthday party.
Right.
All sorts of other people are there at their house. He's separate from them, just tossing golf balls carelessly.
Well, and you see his wife across the pool.
Exactly.
You know, with another man.
And not only do they look at him, but the expression on her face. So they're not hiding it is one thing.
Right.
But she gives him this look of it's both disgust, but she's nervous too, which sets up, we don't know what he's going to do here. She doesn't quite know what he's going to do. And then Anderson uses insert shots so frequently and so brilliantly, again, to communicate story without dialogue. Here what we get is a family painting of the Bloom family. And notice, of course, Herman Bloom, is the only one without red hair in that painting. So you get that there. And on the soundtrack, the crucial music. Nothing in this world can stop me worrying about that girl from the Kinks.
Met a girl, fell in love, glad as I can be. Met a girl, fell in love, bad as I can be. But I think all the time, is she true to me?
It's bluesy. It's plaintive. It has that gurgling guitar. It almost feels like it's pulling you underwater a little bit. I think that's a good example of how music is a tool for Anderson, not a crutch, which is something he does get accused of doing. Well, this moment does culminate in the saggy, shirtless Murray going up that tall diving board, downing a drink, and doing a cannonball.
And he's still got the cig.
He still has a cigarette. And watching it again, I tried to match if it's actually in his mouth when he goes in the air or not. Couldn't quite pick that up. I don't think it's still in there when he's underwater. But
I think Anderson loves this idea of isolation underwater, because it goes back. There's a shot like that.
It is a motif. Yep.
I mean, Luke Wilson's doing the same thing in Bottle Rocket,
right,
the scene. And certainly in Steve Zissou, there's plenty of that.
Where
it's almost like in order to tune out the world's problems, or just come to some sort of weird moment of understanding on your own, you have to literally get underwater and off the planet for a moment.
He likes epiphanies in his films, and they sometimes do take place underwater. I wonder if it's too much, actually, this cannonball scene to claim it as Bill Murray's finest acting moment, and I'll tie it to one of his earlier performances to kind of bolster that. I feel like it's his John Winger from Stripes. It's what would happen if he left the army, went corporate, got rich, and then just became disgusted with himself over it. So maybe that's going a little far, but it is a fantastic Murray moment.
It's not in my top five, but one of the reasons that Murray's performance is truly spectacular in Rushmore is you have, without any forced sense of dramatics at all, you have moments where, in this case, Herman Bloom is accompanying Max Fisher, played by Schwartzman, to his father's barbershop.
Mm.
And, up till now, Max has been saying, oh, yeah, my father's a neurosurgeon, blah, blah, you know, the usual line of BS from Max. Right? And there's just a great, without a cutaway, without overemphasizing it, Murray just simply registers that, oh, this is his father. And it's a very sweet moment because it's not, again, Murray just, would he have been ready to act a moment like that 10 years earlier in his career? I don't know.
The key there is he makes the choice of not acknowledging it verbally.
Yep.
You can see that going on in his mind, making that choice.
Right.
All right, that brings us to our number one Wes Anderson scenes. Michael, which film is it from?
So my number one is very much like your pick with Royal Tenenbaum's climax, in that it's a kind of a summation scene. It's the rap party after Max's play, which is, forgive me if my memory's playing me false here, but it's kind of a nice mixture of highlights from Apocalypse Now and Platoon with a happy ending. Yeah.
Tag him and bag him, Jerry's, we're moving out. Did him out. I don't know, but I've been told. I don't know, but I've been told.
Hello, Esposito.
Will you marry me late, John?
You bet I will.
I think when people talk about, oh, Anderson's cold, or it's, you know, the humor's too eccentric or forbidding or dispassionate or something, he's more of an ironist than a sincere filmmaker, whatever. I don't know. You look at the end of Rushmore and the way it sort of takes Anderson and his camera take the time to really acknowledge every major player and all the relationships and really kind of see some hope for everybody. I don't want to sound like a sap, and, you know, God knows he's not a sappy filmmaker, but that's a sincerely felt moment. And I guess it wouldn't, none of this stuff would really stay with you, Josh, if it didn't have some human reason for being. You know, are there human beings in the middle of these often improbable fairy tales that he's telling? Well, the answer, I think, at his best is absolutely there are. And I love the way it all kind of gets tied up in Rushmore. And that's the movie that was my first Wes Anderson exposure. I didn't see Bottle Rocket until last week. Mm-hmm. So it was a great gap in my knowledge on him. But I thought Rushmore was one of those few times I've seen any kind of remotely commercial comedy where I just kind of started holding my breath about halfway through, like, oh, I hope they don't blow it. Hope they don't blow it. You know, hope it doesn't get stupid. Hope this, you know, God, if this movie can just keep its wits about it.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, that movie did. I mean, there's some scenes I don't like as much as others, but I love the way that ends, and I love the way it's a kind of a panoramic send-off to everybody. Nothing too fancy visually going on there, but very much in Anderson style and just with a full heart.
It definitely has that, and it also has a justifiable use of slow motion, I think, which is something that he employs frequently compared to other filmmakers.
I think almost every film has ended with that same sort of signature shot.
And this one, it's crystallizing the moment in a way that's deserved, because it's not happy in the sense that everything is solved, I think, for all of these characters. But if they're going to be in a better place eventually, it's because of what's happening there. So we deserve to preserve it a little bit more in slow motion.
What's your number one?
My number one comes from, you're not going to like this because it's The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
That's your number one.
It's my number one. And this moment continues to hold up for me. It's another climactic moment, the submarine dive, where Bill Murray's ocean explorer, Steve Zissou, gets his Ahab opportunity. He finally encounters this elusive jaguar shark that he's been searching for. I love all the elements at play. We talked about in Grand Budapest how it incorporates live action, stop motion, CGI aspect ratios. Here we do have a live action shot of a huge group of people within this tiny sub all jammed in there. But there's CGI going on as well. Stop motion effects of the jaguar shark itself. They're done by Coraline's Henry Selick. Wonderfully imaginative stuff. None of this should go together, but part of the charm, as we've mentioned, is that it still works. It still does create this fairy tale world that is uniquely Anderson. Again, like the Royal Tenenbaum scenes I mentioned, and I think like your scene you just talked about from Rushmore, the final dance, it gathers all the major characters together for what's a moment of epiphany. His movies are very much about community, I think, and a broken community and trying to get that back on track in some way. So it's important that the major characters in The Life Aquatic are here together. Now, when the jaguar shark floats over the submarine, a wonderful touch here, again, from Murray. Everyone else looks up because that's where it's going. And Zissou, he just stares straight ahead. He's frozen with awe. I connect it with that Mr. Fox moment seeing the wolf, and he just keeps locked on where the shark had been. Many of Anderson's films, I think, could be written off as blatant, obvious therapy sessions for their characters. A character starts one way and we see him or her progress into a slightly better variation of themselves by the end. I think it's interesting, we didn't get into this, but Grand Budapest notably doesn't work this way. Huh. But a lot of his films do. And I think that can be written off as maybe sappy. I've actually heard some people say he is sappy. But for me, when it's done this creatively and with this much humor, I'm okay with it. Now, you, Michael, teased me in our first live show.
I would never tease you, okay?
Our first live show for talking about how every Anderson movie does have a moment that will bring a tear to my eyes. And you're not going to believe it, but this is the one from Life Aquatic that does it for me. There's something about that realization that Zissou has and those hands of everyone coming forward that, again, it's obvious. You know what Anderson's going for.
Right.
But, hey, it works.
It is beautiful, Steve.
Yeah, it's pretty good, isn't it? I wonder if it remembers me.
If it works, it works. Okay, that's the most...
it's the most you're going to give
me. The most humane response. No, I continue to struggle with Steve Zissou.
Is there a basic element of that film that just puts you at odds?
You know, honestly, I'm still puzzling through why I find that film difficult to access. It's not...
You're not alone. It's the one most people reject.
I think, as much as I revere Bill Murray, I think to have... that actor in the center of a film, which is about a guy who's really stuck, it's not a great match of energies, I think, between performer and material. But again, I have issues with the material from the get. One of the curiosities of Anderson's visual style is that he really loves to kind of deliberately throw you into a whole nother realm, like stop motion animation suddenly. I mean, I when I talked to him a couple of years ago, he talked about originally what they were hoping to do with the climax of Moonrise Kingdom was basically stop motion animate that whole scene, the actual flood.
Okay.
And then they realized, well, you know, let's just simplify it and budgetarily we're better off just kind of doing this. And maybe that's why that climax in Moonrise Kingdom seems a tad flat to me. But I guess, again, coming back to Grand Budapest Hotel, his latest work, that's a case where all the integration of the visual elements really does feel in the best way pre-planned and inspired and just plain fun. So, you know, I continue to think you're a little off on Steve Zissou.
That's okay.
I love a good cry at the movies. I tend not to...
Jaguar Sharks don't do it for you, though.
I tend not to seek it or get it from a Wes Anderson film necessarily, but that doesn't mean I think those films don't have a sincere interest in human beings and how they kind of use all their defenses to kind of prevent themselves from feeling pain. And, you know, that's why the movies... I mean, primarily, they're comedies. Secondarily, they're painful comedies, and that's why they have an interesting texture.
Well, what about honorable mentions? Were there any scenes that you had to set aside when it came down to picking five?
You know, seeing Rushmore again, Josh, just made me realize, well, it's just you just pick every other scene, and you're in pretty good shape. The only stuff I don't really love in Rushmore is the 10 minutes or so in the around the 2/3 point where it just becomes the plot is focused on these series of tit-for-tat retaliation.
Oh, you don't like that montage, huh?
I mean, it's fun enough, but the rest of the movie seems to be working on a somewhat higher level. But, yeah, I love that. And, you know, there's bits in Darjeeling Limited, which I think is not a great film from him.
Neither of us had that on our list.
No, so. Not a great film, but, you know, clearly and statedly kind of indebted to Sajid Ray's pictures. And there's a scene in there which I think is actually some of his best, cheapest, most interesting slapstick, where there's the scene where there's the fight between the three brothers that then ends up with pepper spray and then Jason Schwartzman running into a glass plate door. And that's a very inspired minute. But yeah, I mean, those are two that come to mind. What about you?
Well, for me, I can't believe I didn't have a montage. For all of the times that he employs montages and how funny they are, there's Max Fisher's club montage in Rushmore, all the ones that he belongs to.
I love the Beekeeping Society.
Exactly. Yeah. Royal Tenenbaum getting into trouble with Ari and Uzi. busy and it plays to me and Julio down by the schoolyard. Well,
that's
I like
a great
that.
Hackman just going in the go-kart. So the,
go-karts.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful.
And I also like from Royal Tenenbaum's how we learn about Margot Tenenbaum's sketchy past. That's another wonderful yeah. montage. The botched robbery climax in Bottle Rocket. If there's a moment that makes me laugh out loud, like the one you picked from Rushmore, it's that climax in Bottle Rocket. And the Darjeeling Limited, which is probably my least favorite of his films, though I do like it, does have that amazing tracking shot through the train set that they constructed and used for the film that goes from car to car and incorporates each character, again, bringing them all together, as I've talked about, even some characters who aren't physically in that place. You know, Bill Murray's cameo character makes an appearance there. That's just a really wonderful moment. Maybe there are other Darjeeling Limited fans out there who appreciate the movie more than Michael and I do, or at least considered it more for a top five scene. Please send us your picks or any other comments you do have about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail at 312-264-0744 or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
You know what I'd love to get to, Josh?
I'd love to
get somebody's opinion about why dogs and cats are always getting killed in Wes Anderson films.
That would be fascinating.
Why is that?
Grand Budapest, I think I counted three great jokes about a dead cat. So maybe that's why. Good comic fodder.
And, I mean, dogs are always buying it.
Dogs,
Moonrise Kingdom, Royal Tenenbaum. I mean, these dogs, every dog has his day. It's just a bad day.
You're on to a dark thread there, Michael. Opening in wide release this weekend is The Need for Speed. Actually, I think it's just Need for Speed. It's that quick. Breaking Bad's Aaron Paul also has Michael Keaton as the baddie. It looks a little bit like a Fast and Furious knockoff. Does that sound right, Michael? You've seen this, right?
Have you ever played Atari's Pole Position?
I have.
Yes, that's the next in this series of vehicular homicide video game movies.
So is it a little more technologically advanced than Pole Position?
It is.
Or is this a vintage action thriller?
No, it's 21st century all the way.
Okay,
maybe we'll talk about it.
Also opening wide is Veronica Mars. This is the Kickstarter-funded feature that's based on the early 2000s cult hit TV show with Kristen Bell as the former teenage private eye. A couple of limited release openings here in Chicago, Face of Love, about a widow who gets involved with a man who bears a striking resemblance to her late husband, that features Annette Bening, Ed Harris, and Robin Williams. And a film called The Missing Picture sounds just fascinating, similar to Golden Brick winner here at Film Spotting, The Act of Killing. This is from a Cambodian director who used clay figures, archival footage, and his own narration to recreate the atrocities committed by Cambodia's Khmer Rouge in the 70s. Another documentary opening is Particle Fever. This is about modern physics and the Great Hadron Particle Collider. It's edited by Walter Murch. And as we mentioned in limited release, is the Grand Budapest Hotel. Next week, Michael will be here again, and we're going to review Enemy. This is the Jake Gyllenhaal film where he reunites with his prisoner director, Denis Villeneuve. So we'll take a look at that. We might try to squeeze in a little bit of time for Muppets Most Wanted. I know I'm going to be seeing that and haven't heard about screening opportunities yet for Divergent, but if we're able to get a look at that, we'll talk about it for a minute or two as well. As far as the top five goes, still to be determined, though we're considering something along the lines of contemporary actor-director pairings to go with our review of Enemy.
Yeah, what about classic director-actor pairings?
I think we did that. We're combing through the Film Spotting archives right as we speak to find out if we did that for sure.
It's
an exhaustive research project.
You're combing
Michael.
Through them as if searching for lice.
Well,
I like it.
You could put it that way.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information available at chicagopublicmedia.org. And for Film Spotting, I'm Michael Phillips.
And I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.